Welcome to Just Ask, the podcast of the Hive Collective, a digital health platform built to empower women to make educated and informed decisions about their health. I'm your co-host, Dr. Heather Quayle, a leading women's and gender-related nurse practitioner. We provide answers to the questions you may not know how to ask by interviewing experts in nursing, medicine, sexual health, and wellness. We started in 2020 with myself and colleague Dr. Tara Thompson, pharmacist, and now welcome our co-host and leading women's health expert and nurse practitioner, Jackie Piasta. This is a safe space where no question is off limits, and we advocate and encourage listeners to just ask their most intimate questions and to break down the barriers of embarrassment and taboo.
I'm Jackie Piasta, your other co-host and fellow Queen Bee of the Hive. Each month, we bring on a new guest that is an expert and healthcare innovator in their respective field. As the healthcare landscape rapidly evolves, we are excited to be on the cutting edge and have decided to evolve the podcast into the Hive Collective, a space that seeks to equip you to better navigate your health journey. To learn more about our new and exciting platform, check out our mission, vision, values, and initiatives as we discuss our rebrand in Season 4, Episode 1. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram. We're excited you're here and hope you enjoy our show.
Okay. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Just Ask. I am so excited to have one of my most favorite people. I just respect her so much. She's an amazing, amazing physician. She is all over Instagram. For those who follow me, I try to share her quite a bit in my stories. So I feel so lucky that we get Dr. Jill Kraft on our podcast today. She is a board certified obstetrician gynecologist specializing in female sexual pain disorders at the Center for Vulvovaginal Disorders in Washington, D.C. She's a clinical associate professor in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the George Washington University. She is active in research and has published chapters and peer-reviewed articles on vulvodynia and vulvar lichen sclerosis. She's the associate editor for the medical journal Sexual Medicine, as well as for the textbook Female Sexual Pain Disorders, second edition. And she's a fellow of the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health. She serves on the education committee and on the social media committee, and she shares amazing content on her Instagram page at Dr. Jill Kraft, MD. And I will let her kind of give all that information and how to spell everything at the end. But just the most wealth of information, probably my favorite person, honestly, on Instagram with what she puts out there. So welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. I'm so excited to join you. Talk about my favorite subject, all of our favorite subjects, because this is so important for people to know about, to know that it exists, to know that there are diagnoses, and to know that help is available. So I know today we're going to be talking about vulvodynia.
Yes. Yes. So I think for us and for our listeners, I think the most important thing is for you to kind of start with a little bit of an anatomy lesson for people and kind of the difference between what's a vagina, what's a vulva. We talk about it in some of our other podcasts, but I think it's so pertinent here, especially when we get into vulvodynia.
I completely agree. So, and that's where I start with my patients as well. I always start with identifying anatomy. I say, let me give you a roadmap or an introduction to your vulva. And so the biggest thing is, what is the vulva? It's not a common word that we always use, although I'm happy to see that it's becoming more commonplace now.
Yes.
So the vulva refers to the part that we can see on the outside. It's our external female genitalia. And this is different than the vagina. The vagina gets a lot of attention, a lot of play, but it's really not as important as the vulva. The vagina is that muscular tube that's inside the body that connects from the vulva up to where the cervix is at the top, and then that connects to the uterus. And really, it just expands to allow things to go through it. But the action is really at the vulva. The vulva is the most common site of pain conditions, which is what I see and treat. It contains the clitoris, which is the largest source of pleasure. So the site of the largest source of pleasure as well as pain. And so it's so important to be familiar with it. And then the area that really gets absolutely no attention at all is a part of the vulva called the vestibule. The vestibule is that area that's the entrance to the vagina. When I say that, usually patients know what I'm talking about, but just to be completely clear, so your vulva has labia. You have your labia majora, which are the hair-bearing labia on the outside. Those are protective. Within the labia majora, you have your labia minora, or the smaller labia, and those can be, they can be different sizes. They can stick out a little bit. They don't have to stick out. All of this is normal variation, just like we have different noses and different ears.
All vulvas are normal.
They are. And so there's a lot of variation. And I get a lot of questions about that, actually. Mm-hmm. And so on the top, we have the clitoral hood and the clitoris. And then underneath, inside the labia minora, if you open up the labia minora, you have an area called the vestibule. And the vestibule is really important because it contains some really important structures. It contains the urethra, where the urine comes out. So no, urine does not come out of the vagina. Urine comes out of the urethra. This is a funny side note. I saw someone share a Instagram page of a woman who was basically doing some online dating. And in order to find someone to date, they had to answer a question. And that question was, where does pee come out from in a woman? And so she was screenshotting all of the direct messages or DMs that she was getting. And
I would love to know what that looked like.
Oh, I mean, it spanned anywhere from inappropriate to ridiculous, but it just goes to show that sexual education is very much needed for everybody. But that's just a side note. So the answer to her question is that urine comes out of the urethra, which is actually located at 12 o'clock, if you look at it like a clock, in the vestibule, which is that vaginal opening. The other important structures that are in the vestibule are those gland openings that produce our natural lubrication. And this is essential. When we're talking about dryness, we're talking about pain with insertion, we are talking about those gland openings there most of the time. And so those gland openings are very much affected by hormones, and we're going to get to that a little bit later. So I'll save some of that. The other very important area in the vestibule is the bottom part. We call that the posterior area in medical terminology. And that bottom part is the insertion points for the pelvic floor muscles. So there's very important muscles where there's trigger points that are associated with that area. And if we're looking at the vaginal opening or the vestibule like a clock, we're talking about 5 o'clock.
And perfect. I was just about to say, let's think of a clock since we don't do our video anymore and it's all words. So thank you. Thank you for doing
that. Yes. So we think about that as 5 and 7 o'clock, as well as directly in the midline at 6 o'clock, where the transverse perineal muscles come in. So lots of different muscles, they all have names. But this is why we care about the vestibule, because most of pain with insertion or dyspareunia, or pain with intercourse, pain with sex, if you will, is associated with the vestibule. And the important part is to figure out exactly what is causing that pain, whether that be hormonal, muscular, inflammatory, or nerve ending related. And all of that has to do with structurally how you examine the vestibule and where that diagnosis points you.
Awesome. So that's so informative, and that really kind of helps guide this next discussion. So at your clinic, Center for Vulvovaginal Diseases, you guys have come up with this amazing algorithm. I really am so excited to talk about it, because there are some wonderful, actually, support groups that are out there. There's Facebook stuff around a vulvodynia support group. And so now they're actually starting to put your algorithm more in there, and patients are being really good advocates for themselves. We're still nowhere near where we need to be, but they're taking this algorithm and they're bringing it to their physicians and saying, or their providers, hey, this is what I think is going on. And so I really kind of want to talk through how this was created, kind of, and go through it little bits piece by piece. And we'll also direct our listeners to where they can find it on your website.
Absolutely. So There's a couple things to know. The first one is that this algorithm was created by Dr. Andrew Goldstein, who is like one of the godfathers of vulvar pain.
The guru of sex medicine.
He is. He's one of the gurus of sex medicine. I am extraordinarily lucky because he is one of my mentors and supporters. And so I work with him. He's my colleague at the Center for Vulvovaginal Disorders. We're in Washington, D.C., as well as New York. And so Dr. Goldstein, based on years of experience, based on just the way that we think about this, he created this algorithm. And this is, it's gone through modifications over the past 10, 15 years. And so it's taken different forms as we learn more and as the research has progressed. And so the important thing to know about this algorithm is that, first of all, when we talk about vulvodynia, or more specifically vestibulodynia, we're not talking about a diagnosis. We're talking about a location of pain. And so let me break that down. So vulvodynia, Odinē, was the little known Greek goddess of pain. And so—
I love this little history lesson.
Yes. So adinia means an abnormal pain response or a pain condition. So when we say vulvodynia, we're talking about an abnormal pain response. So basically when I take a Q-tip and I touch something that usually doesn't hurt when you touch it with a Q-tip, you have an allodynia or a pain response just based on brushing that tissue with a Q-tip. So vulvodynia, abnormal pain response of the vulva. Now the vulva includes the entire area, the entire genital area. And so we're talking about the labia, the clitoris, the clitoral hood, all of that. So that's called generalized vulvodynia. And we need to differentiate that from what we call vestibulodynia or provoked vestibulodynia. So going along these same way of thinking, vestibulodynia is going to be an abnormal pain response of the vestibule. Again, it tells us where the pain is located, but it doesn't tell us the cause of the pain, and it's not going to tell us what the treatment is. Only identifying the cause is going to direct our treatment. And so that's the biggest part of this. And what the algorithm does is it basically breaks this down by cause. Now, when we look in the literature and at the evidence, it gets a little tricky because a lot of the studies that have been done don't always break things down in this way. They're looking at all comers of vulvodynia. And so when we see that things work or don't work, we have to interpret those results in relation to what we know about these potential contributing factors or these potential causes. And so we are getting closer with our understanding, but we need to keep that in mind when we're considering evidence-based and research that has been done on this in the past. The other thing is that there's usually more than one cause or contributing factor going on
here. So glad you say that, because the patients I see, I'm like, okay, it's a little bit of hormonal. It's a little bit of this. It's mm-hmm. a little bit of yes, absolutely.
And I have to say, in my experience, it almost always is more than one factor. It's very rare for someone just to have one factor. Sometimes we'll see people that just have hypertonic pelvic floor muscle dysfunction, right? And if I was going to pick one factor that I would see more often, it would probably be that alone. However, if someone has an inflammatory component or a skin condition component or a hormonally associated component, they usually have muscle involvement in addition. And so, and then in addition, the thing that this algorithm does not cover that it's really important to always bear in mind is that there's always a psychological component to this as well. Right? And why wouldn't there be? We're talking about chronic pain conditions. When mm-hmm. pain goes from acute, meaning in the moment, like you stub your toe, you jump around a few times, you rub it, and then the pain goes away. Okay. That's acute pain. When we're talking about chronic pain, where that pain stays, then that affects the way that our nerves work. It affects the way that our brain works. And so there's always a psychological component involved in chronic pain. And, you know, it's hard to say whether it's chicken or the egg. There have been many studies that have tried to explore that. I believe, based on experience, most times people may have maybe some risk if they have generalized anxiety or a type A personality, they might have a predisposition or a risk. But what we tend to see is something called pain-related anxiety. And this is a new term that we're actually just doing research on now. And so it's something that we're really looking into. And this really puts the focus on that this chronic pain leads to an anxiety that adds fuel to the fire that keeps the chronic pain cycle going. So it's not that anxiety causes vulvodynia or it's all in your head. No, it's that the chronic pain leads to this cycle that is perpetuated by the anxiety that the pain is causing. And so I think that we need to bear that in mind when we're thinking about the algorithm and always kind of set that in a whole person and look at the person as a whole as well.
And I think that goes back to, I always kind of throw this in my podcast about just being trauma informed. I mean, we sometimes will take that mentality of, oh, trauma is informed is only if there's been a history of like rape or sexual assault, the hat that I wear a lot of times with my patients. But when you bring up pain, I always kind of tell my patients there is a piece of trauma that goes with pain because you've learned to live your life very guarded and guarding that pain because it hurts. And you're living in that space of trauma, trying to deal with your pain. So I think kind of you explaining that makes a whole lot of sense and why sex medicine providers, et cetera, really need to be trauma informed in their approach to care.
And speaking to that,
do you think too that some of the, for our listeners who may have a sibulodynia or vulvodynia, but that it could be brought on by something like a Lycan's condition or something previously that happened that's now causing it? Or is this something that comes up upon with age? Or I mean, we'll probably get into the hormone aspect of it too, but.
We see many different associated factors. And really it's individualized. Everybody's an individual. Sometimes pain will come and people will ask me, well, I really don't understand how this started. And sometimes I say, well, we don't always know exactly what triggered it in the first place. Some people have a very, you know, they can say this pain started on July 1st, 2011, and they have an exact time period when everything started. For others, it's a more gradual thing. Some people can pinpoint it to an exact circumstance and other people can't. In general, medical conditions, there's a genetic predisposition for a medical condition when we're talking in general terms. And then there's contributing factors and triggers that kind of work together to set the scene. And then there's some sort of dysfunction that occurs. And so I think that when we're talking about vulvar pain conditions, it really follows true to that as well. And why wouldn't it? It's like any other pain condition. And so, and speaking to trauma, one thing that's not in the literature that much, but I think that we really do need to recognize is that there's trauma associated with seeing multiple providers and Absolutely. Not getting a diagnosis and not having treatment work. And so we refer to this as medical trauma. And mm-hmm. we need to really recognize our role in perpetuating pain conditions and, lack of education. And it's hard to look at ourselves when we look at this. And this, this condition is not that old in that, it's really been only the last 15, 20 years, 25 years, maybe, that we've really learned more and more about this. And, even the way that we talk about it has changed substantially. Absolutely. Recently. We call that nomenclature, like the way that we talk about things. But the way that we talk about things is important because it drives the research and it allows us to do deeper analysis on these things. But so it's the circumstance of it. It's not that doctors are trying to be callous or medical providers are trying to be uneducated. It's not that. It's just that we're on the edge of our understanding of this pain condition. We're learning more day by day, month by month, year by year. And people are working on this. There's many Absolutely. People working on this. But, that being said, it doesn't take away from the medical trauma that occurs when a person who is in substantial pain goes to their trusted provider who, in all good faith treats them for yeast infections or whatever it might be. They're not getting better. The fact that the treatment, tried and true treatments aren't working makes someone feel like they're hopeless and they feel like they're never going to get out of that pain, which goes into that pain cycle. And it really does make things worse. And so I'm a big proponent of letting people know that there actually are specialists in this. Just like if someone had trouble getting pregnant, for example, and they went to their gynecologist because they were having trouble getting pregnant, say they were trying for a few months, a year, whatever it might be, and their specialist did some first step approaches, make sure you're taking your prenatal vitamins, let's see if your periods are regular, let's try a medication to help you ovulate, or whatever it might be, some first step approaches, and those aren't working, then that gynecologist would make a referral to an infertility doctor, right? This is like a natural thing that we all accept. We see this with, people that have incontinence issues. This is normal what we do. So I think that it makes sense that if you have vulvodynia or dyspareunia, meaning pain with intercourse, or you're having chronic genital pain, if the first step approaches aren't working, or even if you're having recurrent vaginal infections and the first step approaches aren't working, then it would make sense to me that you would be referred to a specialist who literally does this all day, every day, has lots of experience in it, may have clinical trials that they're doing. And so I really hope that in the future, this becomes something that is more accepted. And that we have people that are gynecologists that are trained in this. We have people that are urologists, nurse practitioners. We have family practice doctors. Physical therapists are specialists in this, yes. In a muscular and nerve components. Yes.
I know.
And
I couldn't do my job without them. I always say
I couldn't either.
And sex counselors, nobody is psychosocial.
Yes. And so there are people that specialize in sexual pain and sexual medicine. And we need to get these people on the radar, and we need to do quicker referrals mm-hmm. to really limit the amount of medical trauma that does exist.
Absolutely.
So I feel like that's so important for those who listen to this podcast to hear, because they come to us looking for answers or wanting to ask those questions. And a lot of people just don't know that there are specialists out there. And there's people, like you said, who are working on this behind the scenes. And that's so important to advocate for patients to look for those specialists and to speak out for their condition. Because if they think something is wrong, there are people who are out there researching that, and there exactly. are algorithms that we can go by to try to get them some help.
I'm going to put a little plug in there for ISHWISH just because it's one of my favorite societies. Yeah. The International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health is where patients can go to find providers that are very specialized in this. Okay. And I think it's just really important that they know where to go. Also the National Vulvodynia Association, but mm-hmm. those are really important things. Can we jump in and do a little bit of the algorithm? I know that you could probably talk to me about this for 10 hours and I would just soak it all in. But I just want to kind of go over a little bit of it so that when patients try to advocate for themselves, they know where to start.
Yes. And so let's set the scene for this. So when we're talking about the algorithm, we're talking about provoked vestibulodynia. So we're talking about pain with insertion of anything that could be a tampon, a penis, a finger, a speculum, at the vaginal opening, which is the vestibule. So an abnormal pain response of the vestibule based on touch, due to touch. And so when we're thinking about this, the way that I explain it to patients is there's four general categories that I think of when I'm evaluating someone for vulvar pain. So I think of these as big categories, and then within these categories, you can differentiate further. But the big categories are hormone-related, inflammatory, muscular, and nerve-related. So let's start with hormone related. And this is going to be just a brief overview. If you want a lot more information, there's actually a layman's book called When Sex Hurts. We are currently in the process of rewriting it, and I'm one of the authors on it.
I heard about that. I'm excited.
It's coming out in 2022. So once I have more definitive plans for that, I will definitely let everybody know. We're really excited about it. There's so much new content in the last 8 to 10 years. And so it's really exciting to get it out. But the original version is definitely useful, and it has the algorithm in it as well. And so, and the algorithm is also available on our practice website. I'll just say that now, just in case anyone wants to pull it up as they're listening and follow along. So it's available at www.vulvodynia.com. Couldn't be easier than that. It's under publications and it's the first link under that heading. All right, so let's start with hormonally associated vestibulodynia. So basically what we're talking about here is a lack of estrogen and more importantly, testosterone at the level of the gland openings that produce our natural lubrication. Those are called the greater vestibular glands or the Skene's and Bartholin's glands. So these are the glands at the vaginal opening that basically create a slippery surface, natural lubrication. So there's not that rawness. It's like, I heard someone describe it as going down a water slide without water. You can imagine how uncomfortable that would be. This is the water for the water slide is what's provided by these glands. And so when hormones are not to the level that they need to be at these gland openings, then the glands don't function properly. And when the glands don't function properly, they're not producing the lubrication, but they also get really red and angry. And anything that touches them is really painful. People describe it as stabbing, burning, rawness. You can imagine it's uncomfortable. And so we see this in a couple different times in a person's lifetime. So we see this in older women who've gone through menopause where their ovaries aren't producing estrogen as much and they're not producing as much testosterone. And so those gland openings suffer. And we call that genitourinary syndrome of menopause, formerly known as vulvovaginal atrophy, meaning thinning. So we see that in that population. And I think that's becoming a little bit more mainstream. People understand that we use local estrogen, sometimes DHEA, or different local medications to help with that, as well as personal lubricant for intercourse. What people may not know much about or may not know as well is that we can see the same exact process occur when there's decreased levels of hormone due to different medications. And so we see this in a small subset of people who use birth control pills. And let me say that again, a small subset. So many, many, many people use birth control pills, but there is likely, and we've done research on this, it was a really interesting study. And you're right, I could talk about this forever. But the long and short of this is that there may be a gene that some people have that make their testosterone receptors not as strong. And so when you decrease the amount of hormone, such as what occurs when you take birth control pills, it decreases the amount of functional testosterone that's floating around. And if your testosterone receptors don't bind as well to the very little amount of testosterone that's left, then you can start to have a breakdown in the system and then your glands don't work as well to provide that lubrication. So I see many, many people, many patients that have this. But again, it's not a reason not to use birth control pills, but I do think it's something that we should counsel patients about. And I think it needs to get out there because if you notice that you're having a lot of dryness or you're having pain with intercourse, just know that it could be your birth control pills, and you may want to talk to your gynecologist about switching methods. We find that our progesterone-only methods don't do this, so your IUDs are fine. The only exception is the implant. We do see it with that, and so there are other options available, but this is a big group of younger women who present with pain with intercourse, and we always want to see if it's related to a medication that they're taking.
Yeah. What about progesterone-only pills?
Progesterone-only pills are fine.
Okay.
So sometimes I'll switch people to a progesterone-only pill. There's limited research on this, but this is just based on experience. The other medication that people commonly take that can also do similar things is spironolactone. So spironolactone is an anti-testosterone medication, and it's used for acne. So a lot of young people are on spironolactone for acne, and we can also see the same process occur, and it goes by the same method. So basically, if we're decreasing the amount of testosterone that's working, if you're in that subset of people that doesn't have a good testosterone receptor, then you may develop sexual pain. And so the treatment for this is to restore, is to identify it, number one, to restore, to stop the offending medication, so just to find a alternative for a medication that may be the culprit. The other thing that can also cause dryness that people don't really talk about are antihistamines, which are used very commonly. So we need to kind of keep that in mind as well. And then we replenish that area with a local hormone topical. And that, you know, there's FDA approved versions for estradiol, which is estrogen. And then there's testosterone that can be used topically, which is not FDA approved, but it actually has some pretty good evidence behind it, both systemically as well as locally. So that's kind of the idea with hormone associated vestibulodynia.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. Super helpful. Mm-hmm. Now let's guide into kind of a little bit of the inflammatory and what that next category kind of looks like.
Yes. So inflammatory is a little more tricky. And so the way that, and any sexual medicine provider who treats people with vulvodynia will say that they get a little cloudy when they get into the inflammatory component. So here's how I think of it. I'm going to break this down. So I think of inflammation as being either internal or external. Okay. If we're talking about internal inflammation, I'm talking about internally in the skin, not really body inflammation. We're not talking about that. We're talking about within the skin of the vestibule. So there can be skin conditions that affect the vulva, okay, or even the vestibule. These are things like lichen sclerosis, lichen planus, that can cause increased inflammation, and those things can lead to pain conditions. Now, those diagnoses aren't specifically considered vulvodynia or vestibulodynia by the book, according to the guidelines that were published in 2015, those are actually drawn out and those are specific diagnoses. So they don't fit into vulvodynia. Same with genitourinary syndrome of menopause, by the way, that's considered a separate diagnosis. And I think as we learn more about this, more of these diagnoses are going to be taken out of the black box of vulvodynia and they're going to be given their own diagnoses. And that's what Dr. Goldstein and I are already doing. But it's just the literature hasn't caught up. So That's what we're talking about here. So we're ahead of it. So I'm making everybody else ahead of it too. So, and then inflammation can also be external, meaning there is a irritant or an allergen or a itch scratch cycle that comes into play that leads to inflammation, which leads to the symptoms. And so that's the way that I think of it, which kind of breaks it down into a pretty simple way to think about it. The idea here is same with hormonally associated, we need to take away an offending agent, okay? And that's easier said than done. So identifying what the offending agent may be, what's in contact with the area that's causing inflammation, whether that be an internal condition or whether that be an external irritant or allergen. And then we use either a medication or emollient to really allow that skin to heal. And so that's the idea here. And there's actually been more research in this area than any others, but it still doesn't make it any less cloudy.
It's very cloudy. Mm-hmm. That one is definitely very cloudy. I 100% agree.
Yeah. And so there's certain vaginal conditions that can actually kind of filter down and create inflammation as well. So I'll highlight one of them. So DIV, which is desquamative inflammatory vaginitis, is something that I see quite often. The reason I want to highlight this is because I think that it's misdiagnosed a lot, because I often see patients who are treated over and over again for bacterial vaginosis or even recurrent yeast infections. And it turns out that they actually have this form of aerobic vaginitis called DIV. And this is marked by a very yellow, sticky, tacky, copious, like a lot of discharge. And that discharge has a lot of white blood cells in it, meaning it's very irritant. It's very inflammatory. And so when that discharge touches the delicate skin of the vaginal opening, the vestibule, which has a lot of nerve endings in it. It's very, it's caustic almost. It can cause red little splotches on the skin. It can cause severe redness on that area. And then it can feel like burning, itching, irritation, discomfort, all of those descriptors that we use for all forms of vulvodynia.
How does a patient advocate for themselves if they think they may have DIV and they want to get checked? Is it a swab test for them, or is it just looking under the microscope, or how do they tell their provider?
Yes. So it's not picked up by PCR swab that most gynecologists will do. The diagnosis is clinical and involves microscopy, which is looking under the microscope. So generally the diagnosis is with an elevated pH. So basically doing a speculum exam, collecting a Q-tip swab of the discharge, and then putting that swab on pH paper, the pH is elevated. So we usually see a pH of 5 or higher. And then we take that swab with the discharge on it and we put it on a little glass slide. We add a little bit of saline, we put a cover slip on, we look under the microscope, and then we look for the characteristic signs. Those are a lot of white blood cells, which is that's your body indicating inflammation. So it's a highly inflammatory discharge. So we see a ton of white blood cells that look like little specks everywhere. And then the other thing that we see are something called parabasal cells. So parabasal cells are basically, so when we're doing the swab, we're basically taking a very gentle light scraping of the side of the vaginal wall. And so some of those cells that are kind of sloughed off the vaginal wall that join into the discharge and make up part of the discharge are on the swab, and then we look at them under the slide. And we can look at those cells and we can tell the health of the cells by how they look and what characteristics they have. And so in DIV, we see what we call immature cells, or squamous cells is what they're called. And so the way that we can tell that they're immature is because they're round in shape, and the center nucleus, if you remember from biology 101, that nucleus in the center looks like a large circle instead of a small circle. And so these characteristics point us in the direction of DIV, along with history of the things that I was talking about, the discharge and the irritation and so forth.
Awesome.
So interesting.
Awesome. Yeah. So I always learn so much from you.
I know. Like, yeah, awesome. Nerding out on the parts of the cell.
I'll be listening to this podcast myself multiple times. Okay. So let's jump into number 3, which is the muscular category. Mm-hmm. And what
yes.
that looks like.
So like I said before, a lot of these conditions have a muscular component, and this makes sense because if you are in constant discomfort, or if you're in constant pain, then what are your muscles going to do in that area? They're going to guard, they're going to tense.
Yes.
And that's a natural reaction. That makes sense to me. It's just the way that the body works. It's like touching a hot stove. If I had you touch a hot stove, you knew it was hot, and then I tried to make you touch it again, you're going to resist me. You're going to push against my arm as I'm trying to force you to it. And so that's essentially what these muscles are doing. They're protecting your body, which is a natural response. The issue is that the factor that started all of this could actually go away, yet your body could continue to have that guarding response. And it gets into a cycle where you constantly hold your body in that guarding stance, which is what causes the symptoms. So the idea here is that the pelvic floor muscles, if you can envision them like a bowl of muscle that is basically at the bottom of your pelvis, holding all of your organs up. And because your bony pelvis is kind of like a circle, but there's a hole in the center. So when you're standing, it's like there's a hole there. And so these pelvic floor muscles fill that hole, and they provide a bowl that kind of just gently support everything. And so when these muscles are tight, all muscles in our body have blood flow that runs through them and to them in the form of blood vessels. The blood vessels carry blood, which carries oxygen. Oxygen is the fuel that our muscles need to function. When I say function, I mean to contract, to tighten, as well as to relax or to release. And that's what makes it functional. If you're constantly loose, then that's a problem. If you're constantly tight, then that's a problem. You need to be able to do everything, be all across the spectrum. I liken it to a rubber band or a hair scrunchie. If you have one that's too tight and you can't put it around your ponytail, then that's not functional. If you have one too loose that you have to wrap around a gazillion times, that's not functional either. So you want to be in the center where it stretches. Mm-hmm. So the idea here is when these muscles are tight, they're limiting blood flow to the muscle, limiting oxygen. However, these muscles are still clenching and they're still working. And so they go from a process of aerobic respiration using oxygen to function to anaerobic respiration, not having the oxygen. And when they don't have the oxygen, they form a byproduct called lactic acid, which causes a burning sensation within the pelvis. It's like running a marathon that you didn't train for 24/7. Mm-hmm. And so this burning basically is in the muscle belly. So when we do trigger points and we feel the muscles, we can pick up the tenderness as well as the tightness, but it also infiltrates or kind of leaks out into the tissue where the muscles are. And that tissue is the bottom part of the vaginal opening. And so that's where we mainly see that burning sensation. And then what happens is that those irritants, the cytokines and the lactic acid and all these chemical factors irritate those nerve endings that are in the tissue of the vaginal opening. And that's what sends the response back to your brain that something is uncomfortable, something hurts, anytime something touches that area, you have that response. And so that's how I think about tight pelvic floor muscles and how they're connected to all of this.
And I think there's even evidence saying that even the slightest bit of hypertrophy, which is like your tenseness of your muscles, can cause a fourfold, fivefold increase in the decrease in blood flow. So there's numbers out there, but.
No, you're absolutely right. And then the other part about this is there's nerves that are involved in all of this too. And so when your muscles are tight for a prolonged period, it can irritate the nerves that are in the pelvis, like the pudendal nerve. It also sends signals back to your brain that keeps you in a heightened sense of danger or pain, which kind of heightens up all of the sensory components, which is an upregulation. And so this is all involved. And that's why with pelvic floor physical therapy, there's many different components to pelvic floor physical therapy. It's not just about massaging the muscles or releasing the muscles, or, you know, it's about education of training someone to know where their muscles are. Mm-hmm. So they're able to actually retrain their body. It's about breathing exercises, because you can think of the pelvic floor as the bottom of a soda can. Guess what the top is? Your diaphragm. And so when you breathe, you're not only expanding and contracting your diaphragm, you're also expanding and contracting your pelvic floor. Think about your abdominals as the front of the soda can and your paraspinous muscles or the back muscles as the back of the soda can. This is all related and it all works together. In addition, breathing down-regulates your nervous system. And so there's many different components to physical therapy that are involved in addressing the multifactorial components of vulvodynia, which is extraordinarily important. And that's why physical therapy is one of the first line treatments and gold standard treatments to pelvic or to vulvodynia that is recognized, in addition to recognizing that there are other skin related things that we need to and hormone related things that go along with that, that we need to recognize and sometimes treat if they're there as well.
Awesome. That goes into all right. And then to the last one, you dived us almost right into that, to the next category of nerve.
Yes, exactly. So when we talk about nerves, there's two separate things that we may be talking about. So I'll start with when we're talking about provoked vestibulodynia or that pain right at that vaginal entrance area, some people are born with too many nerve endings in this tissue. This is a small subset of people, a smaller subset than even people that are sensitive to birth control pills. But, you know, because Dr. Goldstein and myself, we see referrals from all over the country. We actually have quite a number of people that fit into this category. So if you're born with too many nerve endings in this area, this means that even from first attempt at tampon insertion, even getting closer, touching that area, you always knew that something was off. Like that you just, as a kid, you didn't want to touch that area. You avoided riding bicycles. That area was just always a source of like a no-go for you. And so there are treatment options for this as well. The thing that we found that is definitive and works the best is surgery for this, although there are some conservative measures that we sometimes recommend first. This is the only pain condition that really does, that we do recommend surgery for. And so as far as surgery, there's only really one area that really definitively needs it. And that's too many nerve endings in that area that you're either born with or sometimes that people acquire due to a long-term inflammatory process or an allergic reaction in that area, or even related to long-term tight pelvic floor muscles and so forth. But that's the idea. The other nerve-related thing that we sometimes talk about is irritation of that pudendal nerve. So you have pudendal nerves that come off of the sacral spine, divide into two. You have one on each side. They break into three branches and they provide sensation for the vulva. So the top branch goes to the clitoral area, the middle branch goes to the labia, and the bottom branch goes to the anal area and the perineum. And so when we're talking about nerve irritation like that, it's called pudendal neuralgia. And that typically will cause vulvodynia. I use that specifically. So vulvar, generalized vulvar pain, and it's typically one-sided. So that is talking about something slightly different. But again, when we're simplifying this, I like to put it all in the bucket of nerves.
Yeah, I'm like drawing a picture of what you just said. I think this is really important and we will link some stuff.
Yeah, I'm going to definitely link some stuff in as we put this out there.
Do you think that, so are there any, say a patient came to you and they said, and you diagnosed this as the case was, it was definitely nerve related. Maybe they were one of the ones that were born with those multiple or higher concentration of nerves there, and they didn't want to do surgery. Would there be an option that they could do? Is there a topical thing they can take or use or something they can take? Or, you know, is there any other options or would you, before they tried surgery, I guess?
Absolutely. And we always recommend conservative measures. Patients are experts in their body and in their pain experience. I'm the expert in this subject matter, right? And in the pathophysiology and how the body works and things like that. So we need to come together. I present these options to them and then we make a decision together of where to start. And then, you know, what plan B will be, what plan C will be, and so forth, depending on how far they want to go with it. And so we always start with, you know, the conservative measures would be things like sometimes I'll use a topical nerve medication called gabapentin. So I'll use a topical gabapentin. I would say it doesn't work quite as well in someone who has primary neuroproliferative vestibulodynia. Let me just break that down really quick. So primary means you're born with it. You've always had it. Neuroproliferative, proliferative, too many. So too many nerve endings. So born with too many nerve endings causing pain at the vestibule. So if you have primary, then those conservative measures like the topical gabapentin or even capsaicin, which is the active ingredient in chili peppers, which basically drains the battery of your of substance P, which is basically your pain receptors. It kind of wears down the battery of the pain receptors. So those can be something that you can talk about. They're just not going to be quite as effective or well tolerated. And so I provide all the different options. There's also some oral medication options that do have quite a bit of side effects, but it's something that I review with patients. And then we talk about surgery within that. And then we see how motivated the patient is and what they would like to start with. Makes sense. There is ever a hormonal consideration there, or if we're deciding between the two, then I will treat them for hormonally mediated vestibulodynia first. Mm-hmm. I do not go into surgery lately. A patient has to be enthusiastic about surgery for me to do surgery on them. I do not do surgery on people who are on the fence about it, because I find that that is not the right thing to do, right? So someone has to be absolutely gung-ho, ready to go for me to do surgery. You know, I can recommend it. I can talk about it. We can talk about pluses and minuses. We can weigh it out. But really it's just, it's one of the options. We just find that in that small, small, small subset of people, this is what usually ends up the thing that makes them heal, what makes them better. And even if you do surgery, I'm very upfront with my patients, there's still a pelvic floor component in almost all cases. And so even if I remove that tissue, because I'll have patients say, just take it out, you know, yes. Even if I remove that tissue and everything heals beautifully, which I always strive to make it heal beautifully, they still often have pelvic floor guarding from the pain. And so there is dilator therapy that needs to happen anyway, because of the suture line. There's going to be pelvic floor physical therapy that needs to happen. And so I always set my patients up for, you know, listen, like, it's not just surgery and I cure you. Like, anyone that says that, you know, that's not the whole picture. This right. is a process here. And this is, I'm going to outlay the process for you. And then we can decide if that's something that you would be interested in doing.
Yeah, awesome. Absolutely. Oh my gosh. You've given us so much wealth. I think I need to have Dr. Cross part two to ever get you back. I mean, this is fabulous. I plan to share it on multiple channels because patients don't get to hear this, and it's just so important. And you are just a wealth of wonderful information and such an advocate.
Yes.
Thank you.
Such an advocate. I just can't thank you enough. I really want patients to know, our listeners to know exactly how to find you, and even providers who listen. Dr. Kraft is amazing. So I'm going to let her kind of tell you all of her handles and her websites and all that other good stuff.
Yeah, so I can be found mainly on Instagram at Jill Kraft MD. So it's JillKraftMD. And I post mainly on Instagram. Sometimes I'll share some of my posts to Facebook. I'm not as active on Facebook, I'll be honest with you. And people always ask me, I just don't have enough time because I'm seeing patients, we're doing clinical research. And then the Instagram was just my way of my creative outlet for patient education, because I'm no longer teaching medical students and residents as much as I used to in the past. And so I like Instagram because I'm a very visual person. And so it's a visual outlet.
And you have she has such good visuals on there. And it really, I'm a visual and I'm definitely kinesthetic too. If I could like touch what you're doing, it would be just be the whole thing. But you're so good with that.
Thank you. And a word on that, I create all of my visuals myself. So I'm basically like just releasing my brain onto these visuals because it's the way that I think about it. And I also, anyone that direct messages me, I do try to get back to them. I can't give medical advice. So please, please don't direct message me about medical advice. And if you want to schedule an appointment, you don't have to direct message me. Basically you'll contact my office, which is available at www.vulvodynia.com. Also, this will bring you to the same website if it's easier to remember. It's www.cvvd.org, and that stands for Center for Vulvovaginal Disorders. I see patients in DC only because I have 3 kids and I can't travel as much. Dr. Goldstein sees patients in New York City, and he occasionally sees patients in DC. And let's see. And I'm also on Twitter. I'm not as active on Twitter, but I'm trying. And it's the same handle, Jill Kraft MD. So feel free to connect with me there. But Instagram's the main place for me. I'm not on YouTube. I'm not planning on doing that. That's a whole other.
Are you going to TikTok soon? I'm like, I can't get my head around
I thought that. About it. I've given a lot of thought to TikTok, and, you know, it appeals to me to reach a larger audience, but at the same point, I like my community on Instagram. It's such a friendly, welcoming community where, you know, people really know me. And so I think that I'm happy where I am. I'm not trying to be like instant.
And you've grown massively too. Like, you have a pretty good following.
Yeah. And for me, it's really, you know, it's about the personal connection for me. Yes. It's not about how many followers. I could care less. I just want to get the word out on these conditions. And I want to
really done that.
Treat
really
as many patients as possible. So if I do that, I think that you know, if one person reads a post and says, oh my gosh, like this is what I have, and they tell their doctor and they get somewhere with it, that's enough for me.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I can't thank you enough. This is probably one of our best that we're going to put out there. And I just can't wait to get it there for people to just be more advocating for themselves.
Yes.
Well, thank you for having me. It was fun, and we'll have to do it again soon.
Absolutely. So the only thing I can ask of our followers that I ask all the time is please go like us, rate us, tell us what you think about our posts, because the more people we get out there doing that for us, the better it is for our, to get more people listening.
Our patients. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Again, thank you, Dr. Kraft. You've been such a wonderful insight for so many of us wrapping our heads around this and learning, just learning so much. I always make my pharmacy students listen to all of the podcasts. So this is definitely going to be one that they're going to have to listen to and report back to me on. So I really appreciate all of your time and thank you so very much.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Just Ask podcast. And thank you for our amazing panelists today and every day. Feel free to contact us publicly or privately with your questions and thoughts. We do not provide medical advice, but we can point you in the right direction and provide resources. You can learn more about the topics we've discussed in this episode by viewing the show notes for this podcast and following us at Just Ask ATL on Facebook and Instagram. Our podcast is available on all of your favorite platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Pandora, Google, Amazon, and iHeartRadio. Please make sure you subscribe to the show so you never miss an episode. If you found value in this discussion, please share this podcast with friends or leave a rating on iTunes. Thanks again for listening. We can't wait for you to join us for the next show.